Morning. It's 9:30. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona in Tucson, and this is a live reading of the Green Valley News for the 8th day of January. Take a look at what's happening as far as our birthdays go today. One birthday today, and that is Dorothy Ducek. And happy birthday to you, Dorothy. Thank you for being a loyal listener. It's cold up here in Tucson, 46 degrees, and very, very windy, cloudy. Today in Green Valley, windy. Cloudy skies will become partly cloudy this afternoon. A high of 53, winds east at 20 to 30 miles per hour, and winds could occasionally gust over 40. Tonight, mainly clear skies, a low of 31 degrees. Watch your plants, pets, and pipes. And there's another P, and I don't remember it. Winds are southeast at 10 to 15 tomorrow, or 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny skies, a high of 56, southwest winds shifting to north-northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Again, today, 53 for our high, 31 low. Humidity is currently 30%. Cloud coverage 57%. The winds are out of the east at 24 miles per hour. No chance of snow, but there is a chance of precipitation. UV index is 3, moderate. Our sunrise, excuse me, the sunrise this morning is at 7:24, and it will leave us tonight at 5:36. Okay, let's go ahead and see what's happening here in the news. There's a new system that brings a taste of winter and possible snow. Skip the sweater and reach for the coat and cover your plants. The above average temperatures will take a break beginning Tuesday night as the National Weather Service in Tucson eyes cold lows and possibly snow today. National Weather Service expects a 34-degree low on Tuesday, yesterday, 50% chance of showers. Today's forecast calls for 52, 24-degree low, and 40% chance of snow in Green Valley. National Weather Service also expects a 20% chance of snow tonight. Last recorded snow in Tucson area was in March of 2023, and that was a wonderful snow. The Weather Service issued 2 12-hour freeze watches, Wednesday starting at 10 p.m. and another on Thursday at 10 p.m. Green Valley's Thursday low is forecast at 26 degrees, with the Weather Service expecting a 28-degree low on Friday. Green Valley's highs will remain in the mid-50s through the end of the week. Weather Service Tucson meteorologist Dalton Van Straten said on Monday that the cold temperatures and increased precipitation is coming from a separate system that is pushing cold temperatures and precipitation across the central United States. It appears that it's us getting a little bit of winter after a prolonged warm and dry period, he said. The system is coming in from the Pacific Northwest, is quickly dipping down the coast here into Arizona. And with that, it is bringing a lot of cold air and some moisture with it. The system will dip temperatures in here in Tucson and surrounding areas below the area's normal average for this time of year, with a slight increase later in the week, taking the area into the average range. Van Straten said Tucson metro average is around 66 degree highs, and during the last week, the Weather Service has recorded highs from the low 70s to the low and mid 80s. We're going to have the potential for snow to the east of us in some of our mountains areas, he said. Weather Service 2024 climate report for Tucson had the year overall coming in as the third warmest at 72.4 degrees and 58th wettest at 11.52 inches on record. The Weather Service record for Tucson goes back to 1895. It recorded 0 inches in December and October and 0.43 hundredths of an inch of rain in November. While the chances of snow are greater in the higher elevations and east of Tucson, Dalton said that there's also expects the mixture or potential mix in snow and rain in the valley. So that's going to be a switch up from where we have been seeing since November 3rd. We haven't had rain. So with that change, we might see some slick roads and such because, like that, it is the nature of it being dry for so long. The Pima County Board of Supervisors voted 3-1 to approve a new contract for County Administrator Jan Lesher on Tuesday with a $70,000 pay increase. Supervisor Steve Crissy opposed the new contract and Supervisor Matt Hines abstained. Lesher's two-year contract also includes an annual $6,600 vehicle allowance and a $31,000 deferred compensation. The contract comes with 2 1-year renewal options. Lesher replaced Chuck Huckleberry as the county administrator in 2022 after he was injured while cycling. Tuesday's contract took her annual pay from $260,000 to $330,000 a year. Supervisors discussed the draft contract in executive session before holding discussion and voting on it during the meeting. Christie opposed the measure before going into executive session, saying the process was highly suspect, questioned if it violated open meeting laws. He also questioned approving the contract on the day Lesher's previous contract expired. He refused to participate in the executive session. Past county administrator contacts were publicly available before board votes through county administrator memos. The county reported Lesher's Tuesday contract was initiated by the board, which opted to release only the final contract. Peter Yarrow from Peter Paul and Mary has taken in on everything from bullying to climate change in a 50-year career, political and social activism. Later this month, he turns his attention south as he heads for the Mexico border to address immigration. He'll also give a concert in Suarita. But Peter Yarrow has passed away. He passed away yesterday, I believe it was. And he was, what a wonderful singer. He did write Puff the Magic Dragon and Leaving on a Jet Plane for John Denver. And he was the last surviving member of Peter, Paul, and Mary. I got to see them in concert at Red Rocks in Denver. Fabulous. So, we will miss you, Peter Yarrow. Thanks for the music. Laws of Man, a new neo-Western crime thriller set during the Cold War and partially shot at the Titan Missile Museum in Suarita, will be released in theaters and on demand on January 10th. The film was mostly shot in New Mexico and North Carolina. It was pretty rad. It was surreal, said Jacob Keelan, who stars as with Harvey Keitel, Keith Carradine, Graham Greene, and Richard Brake. It was a lot of fun shooting on a set when you're immersed in the real thing. Across the board, it gives an authentic feel for everything. It helps the cast, the crew, and the morale. Filming on site for a project like this required 12-hour workdays, sometimes more. Work Keohane called exhausting, but worth it. The Titan Missile Museum is the site of the only remaining intact Cold War-era ICBM missile silo, which was built in 1963 and then deactivated in 1984. It was declared a National Historic Landmark in 1994. Keohane said The Laws of Man is a film about morality in a tough, morally gray world. It's about ethics and morality and facing blunt reality versus trying to support an ideal or a system, Keon said. There are laws that are created and systems that keep society in order, but what do the people who keep things in order do when you can't do it by the book? Keon said connecting with locals makes the work more pleasant and rewarding. We scouted out west for a full year before going into production and befriended a lot of locals, Keon said. And we hire local as much as we can for crew members when we travel. Arizona was amazing. We got a very warm reception. It's really nice. Stops from being kind of a solo cold business project and becomes more about community. It was a great experience. And did you know other films shot at the Titan Missile Museum included Star Trek First Contact in 1996, A Disaster at Silo 7 from 1988, that is, The Martian Chronicles in 1980, and Capricorn 1 in 1977. Once upon a time, there was a genealogy library in a retirement community. A person could walk in, read some books, and learn about the lineage. The end. If you think that was boring, you're right. Read on for the full story of how the Suarita Green Valley Genealogy Library came to be. Some of the timing here is uncanny. Projects like the Suarita Green Valley Genealogy Library are maintained through charitable contributions. There are also future plans for a larger space if the community proves invested. To donate to the library, you can mail a check to the address below, which I will give you, or drop an in directly at the Green Valley Library. It's called the Posada Life and Foundation Genealogy Library. Attention Don Martz, 350 Morningside Drive, Green Valley, 85614. Don Martz, M-A-R-T-Z, 350 Morningside Drive, 85614. Here's a quote from the library's pamphlet. The library began its life in a genealogy society member's home in 1996 with 200 books from several dedicated individuals who wanted to share their libraries with other researchers. Darylyn Doss, founder of the library as we know it today, recounts the details. We put the books in people's houses for a few months until finally we got the Continental Elementary School. It was a better than space taken in homes, but still impractical. Clarice Bird, a member of the LDS Church, arranged for them to use a little closet, essentially, in one of the local LDS churches. There were about 14 shelves. Doss motioned from wall to wall, describing it. Blessing though this was, it had many inconveniences. First, having collected 500, 800 books by then, many had to stay in a storage unit where they weren't useful to anybody. Secondly, the society was basically in Green Valley, but the church was in Suarita. Bob Vent, who passed away in 2024, had been the librarian for 2 years at that point, but he stepped down, causing a pivot because they couldn't find another librarian. And that's where Doss stepped up. If you go in, Candy Cullen or other volunteers will help get you started with a sample form to fill out what you do know about your genealogy. They and other enthusiasts will share stories like someone learning their dad was their neighbor and siblings were best friends at school. You can learn things like slaves being given masters' names. They only had a record of their age and the sex, both sad and difficult to research. You can also get tips on how to record yours and other stories. Those too often die with each generation. So, knowing the backstory of anything helps you grasp its value. Very interesting. Two Suarita residents were taken to Banner University Medical Center on Saturday night following a head-on collision at Old Nogales Highway and Quail Crossing Boulevard near the entrance to Quail Creek. According to the Santa Rita Fire District, a 48-year-old woman sustained serious injuries and a 21-year-old man was taken to the hospital to be evaluated. Two other patients were evaluated at the scene and not transported. The Suarita Police Department is investigating the crash, which happened around 7:30, caused some delays for about 2 hours. A rocket launcher and rocket-propelled grenades were headed into Mexico before it was thwarted by the United States Customs and Border Protection in Nogales. CBP explained that weapons taken December 28th would likely be used to support drug cartels. Great interception, Port Director Michael Humphreys tweeted on Tuesday. Border Patrol officers working outbound operations at the Nogales POE seized a rocket launcher and two rocket-propelled grenades hidden in a car that was heading to Mexico. The cache was likely intended to protect the cartels and their fentanyl production labs in Mexico. The confiscation comes at a time when President-elect Trump is vowing for major policy changes at the border, including dubbing the cartels as terrorist organizations, this according to Reuters. The decision to escalate what the cartels are classified as could signal a change in strategy in how the U.S. government faces them, as the groups are already major causes for illicit drug trafficking in the country. In addition, Trump is expected to bring back the Remain in Mexico policy for migrants crossing illegally and resume the construction of the border wall. Son of former POW receives his dad's pass. The items have been returned from Laos. This is written by Jorge Encinas. Larry Bailey III had a lump in his throat as he opened a small red box on December 20th. The box contained personal items belonging to his late father that were returned from Southeast Asia more than 60 years after his time as a prisoner of war. Major Lawrence Bailey Jr., a pilot, was a passenger in a C-47 military transport over Phone Sab in Laos when the plane was struck by anti-aircraft fire on March 23rd of 1961. Bailey jumped out and was the only survivor among the eight on board, despite having been hit by plane debris. It marked the start of 17 months as a prisoner of war, POW, much of it in solitary confinement. Larry was at home on December 17th when he received a call from the Department of the Army's Past Conflict Repatriations Branch, an office that he wasn't even aware existed. "I was sitting here one day, the phone rang, and as usual, I said if it's important to leave a message," he said, then adding that he heard it was from the Army and they were looking for him, so I figured it must be something about my dad because he was in the Army and I wasn't. The branch's primary mission is collecting and distributing information to an unaccounted soldier's next of kin and government agencies. The branch focuses on soldiers from World War II and the Korean and Vietnam Wars. The Army sent Larry several documents recovered from Vietnam, including his father's service ID, training certifications, and a document related to his father written in Thai. Bailey plans to have a friend translate it. Larry wasn't sure how the Vietnamese came into possession of the documents. He guesses they took possession from the Laotians at some point when the war began. "We're speculating at this point," Larry's wife, Sandra Rice, said. "We've tried to call them back, but the military takes long breaks this time of year, and we haven't heard back from him yet." The two hope to get more background on how the Army came to recover Bailey's items more than 62 years after he returned back to the United States. Here's his story. Bailey, who lived in Green Valley briefly and passed away in 2015, wrote about his experiences in his 2003 book, Solitary Survivor, the First American POW in Southeast Asia. In the book, Bailey, a World War II and Korean War veteran, said he began serving as an assistant attaché in the Army's Vientiane Laos attaché office in December of 1960, near the beginning of the Laotian Civil War that ran from 1959 to 1975. The Civil War had two main combatants, the U.S.-backed Royal Lao and North Vietnamese-backed communist Pathet Lao. There were also non-state combatants and neutral forces fighting in the Civil War. When Bailey boarded a 747 on March 23rd of 1961, he called the flight from Vientiane to Saigon with a slight detour over north-central Laos as a milk run. But after making his jump from the burning plane, he soon found himself on the ground alone, injured, and armed only with a pocket knife his daughter Lane had given him as an early Christmas present before leaving for Laos. It wasn't long before Bailey heard soldiers about a quarter of a mile away. He called for help, hoping it was friendly forces. When the soldiers arrived, they were wearing U.S.-issued fatigues and carried American-made M1 carbines and .45 caliber pistols. His heart sank as he realized they were soldiers from the neutralist forces of Captain Kong Lei, which had shifted to supporting the communist forces. Bailey was now a POW. He said the neutralists likely didn't know what to do with an American POW. He was initially held at a clinic in Phone Saben, while waking up in a bulky cast for his broken arm, his injured leg, and his broken ribs. Bailey was interrogated by the neutralists. His last night came with a threat to provide information or die. He didn't provide anything and prepared to be executed, but the neutralists put him on a plane and transported him to an unknown location. About 3 days after his capture, Bailey found himself in the Sam Nui in northern Laos and a prisoner of war under the Pathet Lao. Bailey said that his world became a dark hole as he spent months in solitary confinement. He wrote about entertaining himself by watching villagers through a dime-sized hole in the wall that was facing the street on the other side. It was an escape from loneliness. The hole also produced a small bit of hope and thoughts of escape to help keep him going. Around Thanksgiving of 1961, Bailey found himself in a new cell. The new surroundings unsettled him at first, but the English-speaking voice singing Que Sera, Sera offered new hope and someone to talk to after spending the better part of a year alone. The voice belonged to a South Vietnamese soldier who, along with four others, were captured after parachuting into Laos. But the initial excitement abated as March rolled around and Bailey came to the realization that his hopes for peace talks ending his imprisonment probably wouldn't come anytime soon. But by the end of summer, he noticed an improvement in his treatment. He later learned peace talks began in June of 1962 with a coalition between Pathet Lao, Royal Lao, and Neutralists formed in July. The short-lived coalition was long enough for Bailey to get released in August. Reports and sightings that made their way out of Laos gave the army and Larry's family some hope that he had survived the crash. They really didn't know for sure that it was him. They assumed it was because they had some farmer said it looked like a civilian jumped out of an airplane, Larry said. Well, he was the only one wearing civilian clothes, so it had to have been him. Larry was a 15-year-old high school student when Bailey was captured. He recalled the Department of State showing up soon after to ask him and his family questions, including going to his school to talk to him directly. Larry also remembered the day his father returned to the United States in August of 1962, the media frenzy at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. The news media is just pushing us out of the way to get pictures, Larry said. One guy, I don't know where he got it, it's almost like he whipped it out from under his jacket, was a little step stool and steps up on that and got on top of everybody else. And I'm thinking, hey, we'd like to see our dad. Larry also remembered being in his dad's room and President John F. Kennedy pinned Bailey with a bronze star at the Walter Reed Army Hospital. Again, press photographers were there, but this time Larry remembered it going differently, thanks to Kennedy. I remember distinctly President Kennedy. He turned around and said, "That'll be all, boys," and they killed each other getting out of there, Larry said. When he said it was over, they knew it was over. I was impressed by Kennedy. He was a class act. Flying runs in the Bailey family. Larry's grandfather was an airplane mechanic, and Larry retired as a flight instructor and a pilot, and Larry's son Matt is also a pilot. Sitting in their Suarita home on January 2nd, Larry and Sandra pointed to the B-29 photo in his living room, one of the planes his father flew as an Army aviator. He also recalled the memories he had flying with his father and how sharp he recalled all of the cockpit controls toward the end of his life. But what Larry didn't have was many mementos to physically hold and remember his father. But that changed on December 20th as he opened the red box. It was, of course, flooding back with memories, Larry said. I got a little emotional, which surprised me. It had been so long. It surprised me, to be honest. It's history. We all know what happened, but to see it and know that he had this on him when he jumped and the communists took this from him. It's quite a story. Written by Jorge Encinas. It's 9:56, and I'm going to go ahead and we're kind of light on news this morning. I'm going to read this. Back on January 4th, a birthday I share with this man, was the birthday of Louis Braille, born in Coupvray, France, in 1809. He was blinded after an accident in his father's harness shop, and when he was 3 years old, at the National Institute for Blind Youth in Paris, Braille adopted an idea used in the French army to send messages that could be read in the dark. He decided that each letter would be represented by a different arrangement of six dots that were packed close enough that each letter could be read by one single fingertip. He perfected the method by the time he was 15 years old. He published his first book in Braille in 1829, and 8 years later, he added symbols for math and music to his alphabet. But his method spread slowly, and he was not recognized for his achievement during his lifetime. Not a single newspaper published his obituary upon his death in 1852. And it wasn't until a British group called the Royal National Institute for the Blind took up the cause in 1868 that the Braille method became well known. Louis Braille said, "Access to communication in the wildest sense is access to knowledge, and that is vitally important for us if we, the blind, are not going to go on being despised or patronized by the condescending sighted people. We do not need pity, nor do we need to be reminded that we are vulnerable. We must be treated as equals, and communication is the way this can be brought about." Louis Braille, huge contribution to the blind community. Okay, let's get on. Takes care of the reading of the Green Valley News. Once again, the weather is going to be 53 will be the high for today. Partly cloudy and windy, highs in the 50s, lows in the 30s tonight. Windy, cloudy skies, partly cloudy this afternoon, high 53. Those winds could occasionally gust over 40 miles an hour. Tonight, mainly clear skies, low 31 degrees. Winds out of the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. And tomorrow, sunny skies with a high of 56 degrees and winds shifting from the north and northwest at 15 to 28 miles per hour. Thank you for listening. Mark DeGroft with you. See you next Wednesday. Stay dry and warm. Was it all?